Good evening, Los Angeles, and welcome to The Talking Show on K-Chung Radio, Chinatown's only micro-broadcasting station. I'm Nicholas Miller, here, as always, with the inimitable Steve Cato. Steve, why don't you do something inimitable?
I'm Steve Cato. That is my name. It's me.
Wow, great. That was great. Ladies and gentlemen, that was Steve Cato doing something inimitable. And as you can probably tell, Steve is the lifeblood of The Talking Show. I, Nicholas, am just the icing on the cake. So there's Steve. He's the lifeblood. I'm the icing. That's it. That's The Talking Show. It's just lifeblood and icing.
It's a weird cupcake you're talking about there.
Anyhow, we've been having some excellent weather
here in Los Angeles,
California. Wouldn't you say, Steve?
Oh, yeah, totally. Wonderful. Just nice to have it. Great.
Yeah, it feels great to be here. And it's good that we had good weather because Steve and I have been hopping to and fro getting ready for our K-Chung appearance at the Hammer Biennial made in L.A. We are going to be hosting none other than Andrew Norman Wilson.
That's right.
Who longtime listeners of The Talking Show will remember for his incredible performance dealing with cereal, dog breeds, and ski patrols. Was that it, Steve?
Dealing with ski resorts. Cereal and dog breeds.
Yeah, you'll have to forgive me. It's been some time. But anyhow, we're very excited to have Andrew on the show. So given the experimental and awesome nature of Andrew's performance, we thought we'd rev up a little bit with some good old American intellectualism.
Mm-hmm.
I'm at a loss as to how to introduce our speaker today. He has a style all his own, although I think I'll say that perhaps his style of talking and thinking in many ways represents this great country we live in. So, without any further wait, here we have, on The Talking Show, tonight's guest, Dan Carlin.
I have a question for you that I tried to develop as a way to get a better overview of the problem I want to discuss today. And it's something many of you have been asking me to comment on in the last program. We had a guest already pre-scheduled, and there have been a bunch of things along the lines of this topic. And sometimes, and I mean, I know many of you wonder what I'm doing with my time sometimes. Sometimes I will sit down and literally spend hours thinking. And by the way, I recommend this to any of you that have the time to do this, and Lord knows it's a very busy world, and we're all stressed for time, but there's a value in thinking that we seem to have almost forgotten. I mean, where you just sit down and you focus the mind on a topic, and sometimes it takes a long time. And I find that you go off on these tangents, and then sometimes, if you're very lucky, the tangents can connect somewhere down the road. Now, I don't expect you to all buy my tangents and weirdness. I hope that part of why you listen is because the weirdness is worth your time. Today's program might be an example of the weirdness, and I'll get to that in a minute. But let me start off with a scenario that I thought of as a good way to emphasize, I think, what part of the problem I want to deal with today is. I want you to imagine that instead of encountering the New World in the 16th century, as the Europeans did, that we find it now. And we find it with all of our historical, you know, elements in place today, the way we view things now. And now we find the New World. And now we find, for example, the peoples in Central America. And you find them in a state of, you know, a state of, well, savagery is the way the people of Europe thought of them when they discovered them, but we'll call them a state of tribalism, although I'm not sure I would call the Aztecs, for example, tribal. But think about the way we might respond to this. A people who are participating in things like human sacrifice, or peoples in the other part of the Americas that are involved in cannibalism, certainly groups of people that are involved in child abuse, all kinds of things that the modern mind and our modern standards recoil from, some of the worst things that we could have happen in our own culture, and here we discover a new culture that's doing all this stuff. And yet, we discover them at a time when we mourn what has happened to other native cultures that we participated in destroying a long time ago. I mean, if you could go back and replay the way the whole Native American situation occurred, knowing what we know now, how would we do that differently? How would we go about trying to do a better job of either preserving Native American culture, or how about just preserving Native Americans, than we did? Knowing what we know now, what have we learned, and how would we go about doing it? I ask this question because think of how difficult something like that would be. I mean, we can find, and we do find from time to time, new groups of people that have been unfound by civilization. Unfound, of course, is not a word, but you know what I mean. Up until now, you'll find these small family groups in the middle of the Amazon rainforest, for example. Now, what's the first thing we do? It's a combination of interesting things. The first thing we do is say, don't touch them. Leave them alone. Even getting involved with them at all will destroy their civilization. And then the next thing we do is send in experts to study them, which is, of course, it's kind of like the violation. You just don't touch them, but we'll send in experts. Don't touch them, but the National Geographic crew will be in there to photograph them, you know. Now, the reason I ask this is because imagine trying to continue to preserve such a culture. I mean, millions of people in a new part of the world that we hadn't discovered yet in our globalized internet society, but we want to leave them the way they are. Be like Star Trek's, the Federation non-interference policy, right? Don't do anything to destroy that Aztec civilization. My gosh, don't hook them up to the internet. Leave them alone. They have a right to develop their own way. Yes, but they're involved in human sacrifice. Yes, but their neighbors eat other people. See what I'm going for here? There are cultural differences that don't easily exist side by side. The question then arises, who has a right to impose their cultural view of things and way of life on the other civilization? Now, I ask this because of the topic I want to discuss today, which is all this stuff that's happened concerning, well, I guess part of it is connected to the murder of the U.S. ambassador in Libya, but really, this is a larger question that erupted as a result of a cheap film that portrayed Muhammad, the founder of the Islamic religion, in a horrible light, maybe designed specifically like a red cape that a bullfighter uses to provoke a response from the folks in the Muslim world, and of course it did, and now we're discussing freedom of thought and artistic license and all that kind of stuff. As a matter of fact, the other day the leader of the Arab League told the United Nations that they want a ban on blasphemy, a global ban on blasphemy. Now, to the Islamic world, and I don't want to paint the Islamic world with a broad brush here, because the Islamic world is all different. I mean, if you want to talk about the Native American world of the 16th century, are you talking about the Iroquois Confederation up in the Northeast United States? Are you talking about the Chumash people in the Northwest United States? Are you talking about the Aztecs in Central America? I mean, you see what I'm going here. I mean, there are Muslims in Indonesia. There are Muslims in China. There are Muslims in North Africa. I mean, there are differences. There are different sects and everything else. But in a general sense, people in the Islamic world who are devout can at least sympathize with the idea that in their countries, it would probably be an okay thing to consider a blasphemy ban. And if we're going to live in a globalized world, and they're going to be exposed to things from outside their culture, and they have no choice in this matter, if we're all going to be hooked up to the grid, you're going to get our stuff, we're going to get their stuff, and Well, they'd like to see a blasphemy ban then protecting them there, in their homes, on their computers, or what have you. Now, obviously, this brings up problems, right? We have what guys like the late Samuel Huntington said, a clash of cultures here. We have differences in values, differences in worldview, and a difference in the complete way that these societies have developed, whether it be the, you know, the West, as you know, to use that term, or the Islamic world. We're different. And those differences are fine. I mean, you may turn around and I see on some of these websites when you read stories about these things like the blasphemy ban and all these things, you'll read the comments underneath that the people who read these stories write. And it's some of them are just astounding. I don't even believe I'm part of the same nationality with some of the things these people say. But what's fascinating to me is how many of the people that are the most vociferous and just horrible about the way that they treat Islam and some of these things Islam is asking for are some of the same people that if you did The Last Temptation of Christ or, you know, the art that's called Piss Christ, all these kind of things that in our own society create furor amongst the faithful, these are the same kinds of people. They don't see the similarities. That's what I find funny, is they can't notice that they're Christian versions of these Muslims that they have a problem with, right? People whose religious beliefs dominate their entire worldview. Now, my attitude is that there's nothing wrong with that. If you said to me, Dan, we just found these new people on the planet, they're called the Aztecs, and they're involved in human sacrifice, what should we do about that? Dan's going to say, leave them alone. Now, that might not be the right thing to do. And some of you are going to say, well, we can't allow people to have human sacrifice. We're going to have to go in and change that. They can have their own culture to a point, right? Now, here's where the episode we did before the last episode, we obviously had Lawrence Lessig on as a guest in the last episode, but before that, we did a piece talking about free trade and globalization and all that stuff. And there were some fascinating discussions on our discussion board about it. And this is where I think having a background and an education in history is so useful to those of us in the audience who have it. And I'm proud to say we have a lot of people who have a history background, either, you know, through universities or just their own studying. History provides huge lessons for us in ways that in the modern university system, it's hard to justify. These days, unless you can figure out what you're going to do with a job, people don't find value in certain fields of education. But history is a discipline that teaches you about possibilities and allows you to see potential avenues, both good and bad, that people can go to that your normal mind is normally too constrained to see. Example, we were talking about, labor moving to lower cost societies all the time. And there were people on the discussion board that said things like, I don't know what you're thinking, Dan. There's nothing that could ever prevent this. This is how it's always going to be. This is an economic law of nature. Nothing anybody can do will stop this. Labor will always go to the lowest, you know, cost society. And I told these people, you are using an extremely restricted mental view of possibilities. You're not looking at history and figuring out what people have done in the past that will change this game entirely if that's what they want to do. If people want to have a French Revolution, people can do that. And that was what I was saying to these people. You are ignoring possibilities. I mean, you know, folks, a year before the Soviet Union fell, nobody was predicting the Soviet Union was going to fall. So if you had incorporated that into your worldview, people would say, well, what are you trying to do? I mean, that's not even a possibility. The Soviet Union, blah, 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 and boom, it's gone. And practically overnight. The day before 9/11 is one world. The day after 9/11 is a different world. Your range of possible outcomes, options, and happenings changes overnight. There are things that if we had a leader of vision, we could consider that might make the world a less tense, less violent, and freer place for everybody to develop as they see fit. But it would require the sort of leadership without blinders that's so hard to envision today. I mean, folks, we play, you know, this is baseball, analogy. We play small ball now with American leadership. We do little teeny things. You can't imagine even the kinds of things that Jimmy Carter did with the Camp David Accords. I mean, we just don't even do anything that big or risky anymore. Now, we had a president in this country once called Richard Nixon. You may have heard of him. Nixon was considered to be a bad president at the time he was president. Well, certainly right afterwards. Now, here's the thing. Nixon appears to be now, since we've had successors, a giant by comparison. At the time, you were comparing him to people who appeared to be giants next to him. Now you're comparing Nixon to people like, well, you know, folks, people lionize Ronald Reagan. He doesn't deserve it. Neither George Bush deserves it. Bill Clinton doesn't deserve it. Barack Obama doesn't deserve it. These are small ball people. Real people in positions of a lone superpower can change the world if they have vision. I want to talk about the ways you might satisfy some of these cultural differences that threaten to cause huge problems in the future. I mean, like, it's one of those things we'll say, how do you stop a war on terror? How do you end a war on terror? You have to look far beyond the question of, well, we're going to go kill all the terrorists. I mean, these are simplistic, ridiculous solutions that not only don't solve the problem, but lock you into endless spirals of violence that go on forever, and at the same time, destroy your country. Destroy your country. This is the part that no one talks about in the war on terror, that we're destroying the country in order to fight it.
We got to keep Americans safe, therefore we have to turn ourselves into a police state.
Well, folks, if the terrorists really struck us on 9/11 because they hate our freedom, they just won. Would somebody please bring that up? How do you fix that? You don't fix it by playing small ball. And you don't fix it by being simplistic. You have to examine deeper problems. The deepest problem we face here is one of the things I liked about a book that I didn't like overall, Samuel Huntington's book, his famous work from 1996, The Clash of Civilizations and the Remaking of the World Order. Now, this book was flawed in many, many ways, and I didn't like Huntington, he was an AEI guy. I mean, I know that doesn't mean anything to most of you, but there are reasons to not like the book and not like the author, but there were points that he made in the book that are extremely interesting, and they concern this grinding between cultures that don't see eye to eye on so many basic issues that neither side's going to give in without a fight. Go back to my suggestion of trying to encounter the Aztecs and the people of the New World today and deciding, you know what, listen, we're going to let people just develop normally. You have a right to have your own culture, and we'll just leave you alone. And if you're going to participate in human sacrifice and cannibalism and child abuse, that's your way of life, and we're going to let you do that. Can you imagine? Now, make it even more complicated. Imagine that the Aztecs then decide they're going to get involved in the internet too, and they're going to get angry at societies that don't participate in that kind of stuff. And that, you know, make fun of it. The Aztecs are now blowing up train stations in London because some British writer decided to write an article decrying human sacrifice. It's a cultural right. I guess what I'm saying here, folks, is that unless you look at the cultural differences between these parts of the world and realize that this is going to be something that is not going to be solved, unless you allow people the ability to maintain some semblance of the world that they want to create, you have an endless cycle of conflict to look forward to. Now, if you don't mind that, enjoy the future. Continue to play small ball if you're the president in the country. You know, continue to have a world where we're just going to deal with the violent fallout that comes with a clash of civilizations. But I want to propose, if I might, a uniquely American solution to the problem, and one that no one considers because it seems to contradict the amount of, you know, leeway that we actually have. As I said, a history major can look and see how much history can change on a dime and how much you think, these are our, you know, range of options, and that's all we have, and then history will show you, no, you have a much wider range of options than you think, because something will happen that will just throw all the cards back up into the air, right? A revolution, for example, changes the whole range of options instantly. We have a larger range of options than we think. It requires us to do what Richard Nixon once called think big. Now, let's talk about that for a minute. What does thinking big mean if you're talking about the Dan Carlin Star Trek Federation non-interference policy? One thing we in the West do not understand well enough or do not care enough about is what our Western values are doing to the Muslim world, because to us, our Western values are not a downside, they're a benefit. When we bring you democracy, that's a gift in our eyes. When we bring you Western culture and consumer products and entertainment, you know, blah, 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 options and globalism, we're giving you something. It's a gift. You owe us practically for that. You ought to be paying us for that, but we're giving it to you out of the kindness of our own heart. We're bringing you the Enlightenment, and you don't even have to go through all the trouble, right? Don't even have to go through all those Protestant, Catholic, religious wars and the whole church and the Inquisition. We're just going to bring you into the modern world, all the benefits of globalism, and you can thank us later, right? Just give us some oil at a good price. That's not how they see it, folks. As a matter of fact, there are similarities between the religious folks in the Muslim world and people in the Western world that still feel very strongly about religion themselves, and how, to them, modern society is sexualized and debased and corrupt and, you know, anti-religious and, you know, sinful. You fill in all the blanks. They have a lot in common with many people in the Islamic world who see the values that we're bringing to them as undermining hundreds of years of tradition and orthodoxy and standards that many of those people want to keep in place. They're like we encountered a group of people who live a completely different way than we do. 400, 500 years ago, we sent in missionaries to change people like that. What are our options now? And this gets back to globalization. Now, we talked about it with free trade earlier. We said that there are options that exist that people don't see because to them, globalization is inevitable. In other words, if you apply that same level of thinking we were using on economic terms to cultural terms, these people in the Middle East have no choice. Islam has no choice. They get Western values whether they like it or not. Now, is that right? And if the side benefit of that is long-term terrorism, cultural friction, and all the other stuff that comes with it, is that worth it? And if not, what options do we have? And this is where the cultural blinders come into place, and where the American solution does too. For those of you outside the United States, and for those of you in the United States who don't think much about this stuff, there is an age-old, you know, speaking in terms of what Americans consider to be old, a couple hundred years, way of thinking about small government versus large government, states' rights versus the federal government. There's an idea of using the states as laboratories. Now, let me explain this for a minute and why it applies to the larger globalization question. There is a strain of American thought that says that different peoples in different places are going to have different values and ideas and ways of going about things, and that to impose on everyone a standard system is to ignore not just these differences, but the right of these people to have these differences. The people in Mississippi are not necessarily the people in California. Now, there may be a standard with which we are going to ensure a minimum level of conduct. You may say, well, listen, we have a constitution and we have a Bill of Rights, and nobody can violate this whether you live in Mississippi or whether you live in California. But beyond that, we're going to provide room for these peoples and cultures and civilizations, or in this case, states, to develop their own sort of existence. And the good part about it is, if you happen to live in Mississippi and you don't like the way things are going in Mississippi, you can move to California. Now, this is far from an agreed-upon thing, and Americans have been fighting about this for a very long time. Nonetheless, that's the idea behind allowing the states to act as laboratories and to develop uniquely within the framework of a larger, you know, constitutional context, right? You can develop, you know, to a point until you violate the larger constitution. You can develop in Mississippi to a point until you start making black people drink from different, you know, drinking fountains, and then you've gone too far. The point is that if you take that same way of thinking across the planet, now this is anti-globalization stuff, where a lot of people would say, Dan, you're swimming against the tide. You can't do that. Globalization is inevitable. No, it's not, folks. History teaches you that nothing you think is inevitable when people, you know, decide they don't like it enough. You'll have a French Revolution, you'll have a Russian Revolution. Things will happen you don't expect. Buildings will fall down in New York. Hitler's will come to power in Germany. I mean, this kind of stuff happens. There are two things in my mind that the Muslim world could use. Now, these are things that the Muslim world has to be involved in putting together, but we need to give them the space to do this. And they sound like contradictory things. One of them is a greater centralized control. Think of the United States Constitution and the overriding government. The other is more ability within that overriding control to develop uniquely. Think about the idea of states' rights and states as laboratories. Now, we've discussed the first part before. Islam is missing unity. Now, why are they missing unity? They used to have caliphates, right? They used to have the Abbasids and the Umayyads and these centralized, I mean, the Turks used to have the sublime, you know, leader of Islam. I mean, these centralized entities have existed in Islam's past. And what those allow Islam to do is to exert some centralized level of control. Why is this important? Well, imagine if Christianity, instead of having a pope, had 10,000 mini-popes, and every one of them was basically equal to every other one of them. We had this problem, if you think about this in terms of a geopolitical warfare sort of thing, when we dealt with Native American tribes in the United States. And it was a constant problem the United States faced, and it was very similar to what we would face in an Islamic situation. Let me use my favorite Native American people as an example, the Apaches. But it applied to all these tribal peoples that we were fighting. It was a basic problem. The problem was that the control of the people was decentralized. You had no single chief that could speak for everyone. So you would go and make deals, right? You would say, listen, you can't raid into Mexico anymore and kill Mexicans and then come across the border. Deal? And some chief would say, deal. And then 5 minutes later, Apaches would be killing Mexicans across the border and coming back in the United States. And you'd go back to that chief and say, I thought we had a deal. And he'd say, well, those weren't my Apaches. That's another tribe. So Americans realized early on, we have a problem here. We need one Apache who can speak for all the Apaches. But that created another problem. If you got one Apache who controlled all the Apaches, now you had all the Apaches working together and you created a group of people that was a lot more dangerous than all those little Apaches, you know, running around in bands. Instead of having, you know, 100 Apaches who were causing problems if they decided they wanted to cause problems, you had 700 Apaches causing problems if they wanted to cause problems. So part of you doesn't want them unified, because if they're unified doing something you don't like, they're much more powerful. The other part of you demands that they be unified, because if they're not, you have no one to deal with. This brings us to Islam again. And it's one of the things that I liked about Huntington's book that he brought up, and I had forgotten that he even said this, because for a long time I've been saying that the worst fears that a lot of Americans say about Islam, that, you know, they're trying to reestablish the caliphate, is exactly what Islam needs and exactly what we need out of Islam. We need unity. We need a unity that they would find it hard to put together. They have their own factional problems. Unity would be difficult, and there'd be a lot of people in Islam who wouldn't be happy with it. But if we in the West had a single leader of Islam, a United States of Islam, and it had a president and a Congress and people that we could deal with, all of a sudden, many of the problems that we have that are not solvable now become solvable. Instead of 10,000 little popes, you have one. Instead of a bunch of little governments and terrorist groups, you have one government who then can be tasked with the job of controlling their own rogue elements. I mean, one of the things that is supposed to constitute the definition of a state is a monopoly on force within the borders. There is no monopoly on force within Islam. There's force all over the place acting independently. We would benefit from the equivalent of a new Ottoman Empire or a new Abbasid Caliphate. Now, what's the downside of that? The downside of that is instead of 100 Apaches, you have 700 Apaches. Now, instead of a bunch of little states like Syria and,
you know, Iraq and Iran and Saudi Arabia. You have a giant state and they have a lot of oil. This becomes much more akin to dealing with China or Russia or great, you know, nation states. They have the ability, should they decide to create much more havoc on the global stage. They'll have nuclear weapons, for example. Israel will not be happy about this, by the way. They're a group that in some ways benefits from Islam's disunity. On the other hand, imagine that Israel can make a deal with the United States of Islam, akin to the deal that Menachem Begin in 1979 at the Camp David, you know, get-together made with Anwar Sadat. Now you have a deal with all of Islam, and if a group like Hamas or Hezbollah decides to rocket, you know, rockets over the border into Israel, you can lodge a formal complaint with the President and the Congress of the United States of Islam, and they'll do something about it. And if they don't do something about it, by the way, then you have at your disposal, as does anyone else, all the traditional diplomatic and post-diplomatic tools in your toolbox that can be applied to a situation like that, that have allowed states to deal with other states since the beginning of recorded history, including and up to, you know, the military option. And it's a far different affair when you're fighting another nation state than when you're trying to fight a bunch of people who are the, you know, historical equivalent of bandits. If you're going to declare war on banditry, you're never going to be able to end that war. How often do I ask you how you end a war on terror, right? How do you end a war on banditry? But you can have a war and end a war on another nation state. Believe it or not, it's actually the preferable situation. Might be worse in the short run, but there's an end game. We benefit from having larger entities that operate in the post-Treaty of Westphalia approach than we do from trying to deal with what's known as non-state actors. So this is where I talk about thinking big. This is where I talk about Nixon's idea of taking a look at a problem like this and saying, let's sit down at the table and decide if we didn't have any blinders on at all, if we're starting from scratch, how do you fix this clash of cultures where the very connectivity of the world is forcing civilizations to conform to belief systems that are alien to their way of life, and something that people are not going to do voluntarily. I mean, I see so many Americans who are bewildered by Islam's inability or lack of desire to work within this framework. Folks, if aliens came down from another planet and told us everything we do is wrong here and we're going to conform to the right way of doing things and they're the ones providing the right way, how would we feel? Do you have a little cultural sensitivity, you can begin perhaps to see things from the other side. Now, if the other side are, you know, cannibals and human sacrificers and child molesters, it's going to be very hard. And let me point out, I wasn't referring to Islam when I say that. I'm trying to think of the most nasty things I can think of to see if people are willing to really allow people to live in ways that their tradition dictates, you know, they want to live and that they're going to change when they want to change. So what do you do in an interconnected world? This is what the thinking big part comes to. And this is where we get into this idea of federalism. You can't have a blasphemy ban globally. And this is the folks in Islam don't understand this. You know, the West comes from a tradition, a relatively recent tradition, it must be said, of the state and religion being separate things. Now, that was not always the case, obviously, but we've moved past the era where those things were combined. In much of the Islamic world, that's not the case. How do you reconcile those things? Well, obviously, the best way to do it is to allow them to live their way and us to live our way. What do you do when those two places come into contact? We can't have a blasphemy ban in the West. It would be wrong. It would be a violation of our values. Can you have one, though, in the Islamic world? Well, yes, of course you can do that. That's no problem at all. The problem is, what do you do with something like the internet where the blasphemy in Great Britain, or the blasphemy in Holland, or the blasphemy in that film in the United States makes it on YouTube, and then they download YouTube in Saudi Arabia, and boom, all of a sudden the blasphemy has crossed borders. Well, and it's funny for me to be arguing this as a freedom guy, but this is where maybe censorship comes in. If Iran, which is building apparently their own version of the internet now to make it, you know, Islamically friendly from an Iranian point of view, The Chinese are doing the same thing in China, and of course they're doing it in ways that will protect the government. So this is something that will keep those people even more firmly under the foot of their government. But it allows these societies, as much as possible in a globalized world, to control their culture, or maintain it would be a better way to put it. Because see, here in the West, the whole idea of controlling culture is even a thing of the past. We don't control culture. Culture does what it wants. If Elvis Presley arrives in, 1957, Elvis Presley's here. Rock and roll's here. We don't stop it. We don't pass laws to end that. That's a Western value. To suggest that that's a human value, well, that's more of a problem. And something the Chinese have brought up before, and yours truly has been on the other side of that issue, by the way. So if you're part of the hypocrisy police, Dan Carlin perhaps deserves a minimum amount of time and hopefully a minimum security prison for this. But I've pointed out that when the Chinese declare things like human rights, which is the term we use here in the West, are really Western rights, and that they can treat individuals in China in ways we would consider to be barbaric because of our history, and that China's history is different, I've said that that's a crock, and that those people have just as many, freedoms and rights in terms of the Great Enlightenment ideas of what you're born with as we do. But what if the people of China don't think so? I mean, if I think human sacrifice is one of the worst things anyone can do, and I go to a time machine and I go back to Aztec society and I tell the Aztecs this, and 99.9% of Aztecs tell me I'm crazy, who's right in that situation? Now, I am stubborn. I'm going to tell those Aztecs that they're wrong. But do I have a right to impose my will then on them? Now, here's the thing. The Chinese, if they agree with me on this secretly, and they're not allowed to say so because they're being, kept under the boot of their government, well, they have every right to overthrow that government. And this happens all the time, right? This whole Arab Spring is kind of an example of that. And in the same way, if the people in the Islamic world, let's just take Iran, for example, decide that it's really their government and their clerics and people that maybe they don't really agree with that want this separate Iranian censored internet, and they don't. They want all the porn and all the movies and all the YouTube and all the blasphemy we can give them, then they have a right to overthrow their government and take it. Now, I know to a bunch of you, this is probably going to look like some sort of violation of my foreign policy ideas, because they are simplistically thought of by some people to be completely isolationist. What I always tell people is, no, they're really non-interventionist. And that doesn't mean you can't be involved in all sorts of world affairs. It just means you don't have 700 bases around the world. You're not in 120 countries. You're not looking for military solutions to every single problem. I mean, take, for example, and this guy was an interventionist president, by the way, but take, for example, the way a guy like Teddy Roosevelt in 1905 handled the Russo-Japanese War when Russia and Japan were going at it in the Far East. He got involved, not militarily, he got involved in bringing both those people to the table so that they could sign a peace treaty and end that war. No military involvement at all. He won the Nobel Peace Prize for that. I have no problem with that, with my foreign policy ideas. I have no problem with making the world a better place. My problem with making the world a better place is when we have to kill a lot of people to do it. In any case, just want to point out that this is perhaps a refinement of my idea that we haven't always gone into all the little nooks and crannies about concerning how U.S. foreign policy should be involved in, the affairs of other countries. If we can be helpful in a peaceful way, I'm all for that. I don't want to encourage blowback, but I'm not sure that, helping the Middle Eastern folks deal with problems that, let's be honest, folks, we haven't talked about this very much either, are in large part the West's fault, is going to incur the same sort of blowback that, the things we've done up till now have incurred. We haven't talked about the legacy of colonialism, and most people don't. It's something Huntington deals with in his book, too. He goes through the actual numbers. I mean, the amount of colonialism in the Islamic world was overwhelming in our grandparents' day. Those borders, those countries, these areas of friction between peoples, a ton of that is our fault and Britain's fault and France's fault and all these countries that went in there and divided this area up for its resources and for its ability to dominate strategic places.
You know how long it takes normally to shake off the effects, the long-term effects of something like colonialization? We said in a recent episode we were talking about slavery, and we talked about how long it takes to shake off the effects of that. These are not things that go away in a generation, folks, and yet people will sit there and suggest that, you know, African Americans need to stop talking about slavery. It was so long ago. Folks, this is stuff that takes generations normally. A lot of what's behind this Arab Spring, this is still shaking off the effects of colonialization, and the people who did the colonialization, yeah, that's our side of this globalization, force our Western views on your traditional society side of things. It's important to point that out, too. We don't need to take the blame for everything, folks, but if we take the blame for nothing, then the people in that region look at us and say, you did all this to us and now you're mad that things are unstable? Why do you think they're unstable? Well, in large part, they're unstable because that's how we wanted it for a long time. We wanted the opposite of a centralized authority in the Middle East. After all, after the First World War, we got rid of the one they had. Now, how does that fix our problems? Well, I don't know that it fixes them. What it does is it prevents us from appearing to impose our way of life on other people. And you can go through Huntington's book, for example, but you can go through about 1,000 other books where they make a wonderful point about the different way the Islamic world views our involvement with them compared to what we view it. We are remarkably arrogant here in the West about what we have done to people in the Muslim world, and the Middle East specifically, but all over the Muslim world, and then we're so stunned when they attack back. I mean, Huntington goes through and talks about the military involvements. I mean, here's something Huntington says, and this is an example of things most Americans don't realize. And this is written in 1996, so quite a bit of time before the Twin Towers fall down, right? Huntington writes, quote, "During the 15 years between 1980 and 1995, according to the U.S. Defense Department, the United States engaged in 17 military operations in the Middle East, all of them directed against Muslims. No comparable pattern of U.S. military operations occurred against the people of any other civilization." End quote. Since then, of course, we've done it quite a bit more. We don't understand, we don't pay attention, and the news media doesn't highlight the reaction that the people on the other side have to this. Folks, we're just now beginning, some of us, to wake up. Well, not arrogantly, but I've been here a long time. Many of you have been here a long time. Many Americans are just waking up to the fact of how angry people who are being attacked by these drones in places like Pakistan and Yemen are. And then we react with such horror when these people strike back. What would we do? Stop it! I mean, we're so silly about this. I read, as I said, the comments from people, oh, it's just, we just paved the Middle East. These people are barbarians and savages and animals. What would we do? Are you crazy? We have a total inability to put ourselves in the shoes of the other guy. The first thing we would do if Muslims came over here and started telling us how we had to live, or if they invented the internet first and started beaming their culture into ours and telling us that women needed to be veiled and I mean, whatever it was, folks, how would we react? We'd react just like they did and just like they do. Their reaction is a human reaction. And the question is do human beings have a right to dictate their own societies and their own cultures? If your answer is no, okay, well, just understand that that applies to you too, that other cultures, you've just given them the right to dominate yours. If you think, yes, absolutely, people have the right to determine for themselves, right, we'll take a Western value here, how their culture is going to be, well, then if you want to be a president who thinks big and who's looking at this war on terror in a much larger clash of civilizations, you know, civilizations rubbing up against each other in ways where, well, in the case of the peoples of the Americas, it just destroyed them, then how would you solve that problem this time? Can you carve out a space where people can live as much as possible the way that they want to and not have a completely alien way of life and worldview imposed upon them? I would suggest that it's possible, and I would suggest that we have put very little thought into it.
for those of you who say, listen, this globalization is inevitable. Dan, the people of the Middle East are just going to have to suck it up and accept all this because this is the new world and there's no way for anyone to remain separate from the whole anymore, then I would say to you that you have blinders on that are constrained by, you know, the range of possibilities that exist until you're proven that the range of possibilities is always wider than you think it is. The Soviet Union falls the day before it does. You don't think that's possible. 9/11, the French Revolution. I mean, over and over and over again, folks, history proves that people will confound what you think the range of possibilities are. We actually have the chance, if we had a president, and I'm not slamming Obama here or Romney or any of them, we haven't had a president who thought big, to quote Richard Nixon, in a very long time. Someone who would take the chance to convene summits and councils and meetings. I mean, why not call the Islamic world together multiple times and have summits about ways to deal with this issue? I mean, if they're calling for blasphemy bans at the UN, it seems to me that a counteroffer is in order. An ability to sit down and say, listen, we can't go for that. It's against our cultural traditions and beliefs and our way of life. But we understand you have a different way of life. Let's sit down and see if we can find a way to let you live your way of life as much as possible and allow us to live ours. Will there still be terrorists? Sure there will. We have our own. But it will allow us to diffuse this idea that we are mandating that others live our way and that their societal values that go back hundreds, in some cases thousands of years, have to give way to a globalized culture that, let's be honest, folks, is Western in orientation and non-religious for the most part in orientation. You wouldn't put up with that for 5 minutes if you were on the other side of it. It should be no surprise that there are people on the other side of it who don't want to either. Walk a mile in their moccasins and then say, okay, what can we do to make it better? One promise. It's not going to involve tweaking. It's going to involve massive change. You can either try to instigate and control this massive change yourself and, in effect, take pressure off the situation. Or you can wait until events do it for you. When events do it for you, history has shown oftentimes we are much less satisfied with the results.
Yeah. Wow. Wow. Dan. Yeah. You can say that again, Steve.
Dan.
Woo. Well, you know,
Dan,
I, on the surface, at least, like the thesis of the Enlightenment as a virus. Although, let's be fair to Dan. He walked into a snake's nest here. He had no idea that he is dealing with two highly venerable experts on the Enlightenment, wouldn't you say, Steve?
I think it's putting it on a little thick, but yeah, sure.
Okay, not experts, but
yeah,
you know, we think about it more
we
than
do.
Your average
yeah,
Joe.
Definitely.
More than Joe the Plumber.
Joe the Plumber,
we
no.
think about the Enlightenment more than Joe the Plumber.
I think that's very safe to say, yeah.
Right. I don't know. My review would be pretty simple. Undialectical.
Yeah, I think that's clear. I mean, dialectics is very un-American in actual fact.
Yep. Nope, that did not appear to me to be one of his argumentative strategies or modes of thinking. And I don't know how you can look at that period of history, especially thinking of it as intellectual history, undialectically.
I think we just saw how someone would go about doing something like that, don't you? I mean, he's, in a way, operating from a less idealist and more sort of intuitive perspective. Like, how would you feel if you discovered the Aztecs or something like that? That's,
yeah. The chicken and the egg.
Yeah.
Same time.
Yeah. Yeah. Dan.
Anyhow, he did a great job of bringing some of the triumphs of the Enlightenment into close tension with some of America's great foreign policy. although, you know, I'm a little rusty on colonial theory, or post-colonial theory, rather.
Right, right.
I felt like that got fumbled, wouldn't you say, Steve?
I don't know. I mean, sure, in terms of some of the ways that, some of the terms he used to discuss things, I think lots of people would take issue with. But I think the overall intention was gentle.
Yeah, no, I agree completely. Well, thanks anyway, Dan. Thanks for coming out on the show. Dan has a giant archive of hot air out there on the web. If you just Google his name, you will undoubtedly find it. And there are really some quite nice lectures on history. I think it's called, I'm failing here. Hardcore History.
Yeah.
I think it's called Hardcore History.
Hardcore.
It makes history macho and masculine as if it wasn't already. So I encourage you all, if you enjoy the talk, to go out there and
hardcore.
Listen to some of those. They're quite long, so maybe a road trip material. Because, you know, the summer's coming up. A lot of you are going out to, you know, Zion or some other national park with your significant other.
Mm.
And you may need some hardcore listening to get you through that big desert between here and there. So, please, everyone, come to the Hammer at some point during the biennial and see what we have to offer. Good night.
Good night.